a sound.
Esoteric.
Yes, esoteric.
It's like a schwa.
Yeah. And so on that note, we are on the air.
Welcome, everyone.
Welcome, everyone, for another episode of the Crypto Science Society podcast. My name is Jason Cordova, the president and co-host. And to my adjacent to me is...
I'm Janae. That's all you get. I am Janae. I've become like the share. Do I do the co thing as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Co-host and
resident. We are in my house this time. So we're gonna come into you at a different location.
On location. And we have with us a very, very special guest, Savannah Powell, folklorist and Crypto Science Society Special Operations Agent. Why don't you take a moment and introduce yourself a little bit more?
Yes, so I am currently working on a master's degree in Estonia. I'm studying folklore in a cozy little town called Tartu. And I guess I'm the secret agent or the special agent? Special operations agent, because...
We just like to come up with titles, because why not?
Yeah, and I'm often traveling around and visiting interesting sites and such, so, yeah.
And there's really no other way to categorize you other than special ops.
You can tell we take ourselves very seriously.
Yes. Yes, we do. Why don't we start off, get right into it. We're going to talk a little bit today about Savannah's experiences and research in Estonia. Some things she's come across regarding hauntings, werewolves, mythological creatures, and really anything else we can uncover about the mysteries of Estonia. So, Janae, why don't you go ahead and start off with some questions I know you have lined up.
Huh? Yeah, so just to kind of get the ball rolling in terms of, like, seeing where this conversation goes, because it's always interesting. We always have, like, a layout, and then it kind of meanders. So it's always fun to see what happens. So in terms of, like, just kind of what got you really interested and fascinated with, like, folklore and sort of those stories and leading you to kind of decide to research and study it?
Yeah, so this was actually a long time ago. I was working as a nanny in France, and I took some time to travel around and did this tracing my heritage kind of trip. Going through different countries and such, and exploring my Jewish heritage, which is a bit depressing through Europe. But I experienced a lot of, like, and encountered a lot of, like, really touristic kind of things that I didn't enjoy, and came back to the United States and wanted to connect more with traditional heritage, authentic heritage, whatever that might mean. And I discovered an Eastern European folk ensemble based in Denver called Planina, and that kind of started me on this path of wanting to learn more about folklore. I discovered there were a couple of members who have studied folklore in that group, and I ended up traveling to Eastern Europe and then decided, I should probably spend more time there, and so I ended up applying to my program that I'm currently involved with and getting very involved with studying folklore. It's fun.
Well, and to kind of piggyback off of that, why would we talk about folklore in terms of, like, a crypto science podcast, Jason or Savannah?
Well, actually, I think folklore is a fundamental core of what we explore in crypto science. Everything. You know, so many stories, legends, tales, a lot of it is tied to stories that people carry with them and keep with. and when a cat is you know, cat sightings bumping up against your belly.
Just to give you some context, my cat has decided to sit on laps and purr very loudly. So if you hear that through the audio, that's why.
We got that. What, really, though, I think Sven is the expert on that.
On folklore? Or cats purring?
Yes, to both.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I do enjoy both. Well, yeah, I mean, it's been really interesting studying folklore because it's such a broad subject area. And I'm really focusing on folk ensembles, but I also have a lot of interest in ritual magic. And there are a lot of people who study possessions and channeling of deities in my department. There's a number of people who have connections with universities and with communities in India, and so they do a lot of studies around indigenous traditions and rituals that they have in India, which are really fascinating. So, yeah, I mean, that's just like the tip of the iceberg. You can study almost anything. Because folklore is what people do, so.
That's a really awesomely concise definition.
I'm missing plenty of things there, but.
So there are a couple stories that I know you've told us about some of the hauntings and things that the goings on there at in Tartu and University area. So could you tell us a little bit about the place known as Tome Hill?
Oh, Tome Hill. So Tartu is a very small and cozy town, and near the city center is a very high hill. I mean, Estonia is mostly a flat country, very flat, but it gets a little hilly from place to place, so when there's a hill, it really stands out. And Tome Hill is a very historic section of the city. There's a very large medieval cathedral on top of the hill that... it was never fully completed, so it looks like the skeleton of a cathedral. It's really, it's gorgeous and kind of etheric and eerie all at the same time. They completed one small section of it that is a building. It's actually a museum that has a number of interesting, it's a university city museum. There's interesting things in there, but when they've done a lot of excavations, they've found bodies there. They've discovered that, you know, there were plague victims buried nearby, possibly nobility, and they've made those folks part of the museum, the remains, which always creeps me out a little bit. But there's a lot of stories of hauntings up on Tome Hill, too. There's a story about a woman who was built into the cathedral. This is a typical kind of tale that goes along. I've heard it in Eastern Europe quite a bit, where they're trying to build a structure, either a church or a bridge, and they start building it and then it falls down, or they start building it and something doesn't work. So they're like, oh, we have to make a sacrifice. We'll go find a virgin. And they build her into the bridge or the wall of the structure. So there's a similar story like that around Tome Hill. And something about, like, on autumn nights, if a young woman goes in that area, she has to be very careful because the spirit might try to trade places with her. And this was kind of mixed up with another story of a young woman who, or a spirit, who was charged with protecting the hidden treasure of her family. And she was, like, looking for another young woman to take her place.
I think that's interesting, especially in terms of, like, folklore, and especially when you say it's like what humans do, sort of like the interest, the replication of certain stories in different places. Like,
yeah.
I think I'm remembering a, like, what's it called? Not The Outer Limits, the other one.
Twilight Zone.
Thank you, Twilight Zone. where somebody was being like walled up. So that's like the whole like idea of being walled up or like entrapped, or you know, like a spirit wanting to trade places and like trick somebody. I think that's really fascinating. Be interesting to kind of those records and stuff. Like, where is that coming from? Why? Like, what sort of like ritual magic in terms of folklore is maybe based off of that? Would be interesting.
Yeah.
Now, do you have any personal experiences? Have you had any encounters or had any interesting firsthand stories that you can share?
I haven't had any encounters of my own in Estonia, but most of my experiences there have been just spending time with locals and hearing stories from them. When I first arrived in Tartu, I attended a small conference for a student organization that took place at a country house, and they had a traditional Estonian sauna, which is wonderful. It's a very important part of their culture. And as I was in the sauna, it felt ritualistic in a way. I mean, there's a lot of culture built into the way they do it. And so I kept asking Estonians, like, do you have magic or traditions or songs around the sauna? And a lot of people kept saying, no, I don't think so. And finally, I met a scholar who specializes in that area. And she said, oh, yes, the sauna, people would go there to give birth, or to after someone died, they would bring them there to clean them up. But there were also ritual and magic that would happen within the sauna, like singing songs while doing certain things.
Yeah, kind of like a sweat lodge. but there's a lot of ritualistic magic. It's like traditions that are maybe kind of detached a little bit. Do you feel like that's... do you get the sense that that's what's going on? Or is there a strong ritual tradition using those practices?
It feels a little bit detached in a sense, maybe in a way that, you know, this tends to happen in the modern world. But Estonia is interesting because they're more atheist than many other countries. And they had some pretty strong pagan traditions. And there are signs of this in the landscape. For example, on Tome Hill, there's I think it's either called an offering stone or a sacrifice stone. And it's basically a boulder, but it has a lot of like little pock marks in it. And people will leave things there. And when I discovered this, I thought it was pretty interesting. They took one of these stones that they had found somewhere in the countryside, and they placed it in their national museum in Tartu. And people have left things on that offering stone inside the museum. So there definitely could be this resurgence kind of traditions. I've seen that also in Latvia and Lithuania. And Lithuania held on to paganism longer than anyone else in Europe, I believe. They held out the longest. And there are some people trying to bring those traditions back. There's really beautiful songs and practices they have around solstice time. And there's also like a pagan metal festival that looks pretty awesome down there.
Well, that's interesting too, because like going back to just like breaking down the idea of like ritual magic, sometimes ritual is just the day-to-day habits that we have, you know, the things that we kind of do that are automatic. And sometimes when they become so automatic or so interwoven. Sometimes like the origin point of it might not be as known anymore because it's sort of adapted and changed, and or, you know, because of other reasons like war and colonization and things like that get changed or stolen or in different ways as well. So that sort of magic and ritual kind of gets woven in a different way. So you have like a haunting of that stuff, but it's the history of it might not be there as much.
Yeah, it's very it's very apparent in like these vernacular traditions, the common practices of the people. But it's also visible in like pop culture to some degree, because there's a musician Curly in Estonia. She reminds me a little bit of Lady Gaga, but I should be careful about saying that because I know she feels like Lady Gaga has stolen a bit of her, you know, her style. So Curly has made a series of music videos that directly reference Estonian mythology, and she becomes the mythological creatures, which is, it's actually really beautiful. So that's one way that it's like been woven into contemporary culture.
Well, and to kind of talk, like, since you kind of mentioned music and since your focus is on ensemble and music in general, just sort of speaking to the idea of like ritual magic and folklore and music and sort of the importance of that, or like experiences you might have in terms of magic and sound.
That's an interesting question. My experiences with that, I mean, I've been involved with rituals before where music is always a really important part of that, from in many different cultures. And I've also talked to other like ritual practitioners who are also musicians, and I've heard them say things like, well, every time I sing, it is a prayer, and every time I sing, it's imbued with power. And I really took heart, you know, I took that to heart. And I find it interesting. It makes me pay much more attention to lyrics. So I study many different kinds of music, Eastern European music in different languages, and I don't speak those languages, but it's very important to me that I, like, understand the meaning behind that. And I've been working with an ensemble in Estonia called Vaike Hellero, which is led by a number of ethnomusicologists. They're like highly educated and just really do phenomenal work, and they work with archives to like pull up these source recordings and watch these super old black and white films of how people are doing these dances, these folk dances, and reconstruct everything. And I've been singing with them and listening to them sing, and they have so much awareness of the context. And I'm reminded of one of the folk songs and dances we do. We sing, and while we're singing, we're spinning. Each of us is making like a circle within a circle. So that, with these specific steps with our feet that are very precise, but I've never been so dizzy in my life, and it like reaches almost like a trance state because you're also singing so much that you're out of breath at the same time that you're spinning. And I think one of the singers also said like, oh yes, you know, this is kind of not just ritualistic, but you can reach an altered state by doing this. So it's really powerful.
Yeah, it is. I'm reminded like when you're a little kid, first discovery, it's can spin and spin and spin and spin, and like, yeah, it's reaching, like, it's kind of like, I mean, not to trivialize it at all, but I think that's kind of a fundamental, you know, a very basic fundamental recognition of those kinds of altered states. And I know there's other traditions throughout the world, like the whirling dervishes, they do that, with a very intentional purpose to create those kind of altered states. That's pretty fascinating. It's really cool.
Well, and this kind of speak to your lineage too, in terms of like the drums and the different like vocalizations and intonations that happen in terms of ritual.
Right. That's actually really interesting too, as far as, incorporating the power of sound and the power of tone, inflection, intention, those sorts of things. And like there's you'll notice if you ever hear a Native American recording of a song or kind of the stuff they do in powwow, it's not the same stuff that they do actually in the ceremony. There's always a slightly different thing because it's a very important to use those songs in a responsible way.
Yeah, I was just reminded of so Estonian or Finno-Ugric people, and this is a linguistic group, and they're also connected to a series of just indigenous groups that are in the northern regions, in the Baltics, in also in Russia and Siberia, and this includes the Sami people, and the Sami have a certain ritualistic singing style called yoiking. I actually don't know a lot about it, but I was at a folk music festival in Kaustin in Finland, which is pretty far north. It's like 4 to 5 hours north of Helsinki by bus. And I saw a Sami person who did mystic yoiking with a violin, which I don't think that's typical or necessarily a traditional way to do it, but it was amazing because I think it might involve a drum. I've seen people do or like patting on with your hands on the lap or something. You have to get some very interesting rhythms, and then there's vocalizations, and he was just doing it with his feet. He was stamping his feet while playing the violin and then like making these vocalizations that are, it to me, it sounds like it's imitating animalistic or sounds you might find in nature, and it's really interesting. When I was witnessing this and I was looking at the audience, it's like we were all being brought to another place.
Well, and I know I have, I've been in situations where I've experienced that sound affecting me, right? The music, you know, there's been studies that show that music has profound effects on the way your brain functions. And we've even been talking in previous podcasts about this idea of sound affecting a phenomenon, right? Infrasound, even say some of these cryptid creatures, maybe being able to use some kind of infrasound to affect the emotions and the perceptions of a witness. This idea of sound in ritualistic magic having a very a clear reaction. And then going back to the ghost thing, I mean, what's the best? It seems like all the best evidence of hauntings tend to be the EVPs, right? The weirdest, most remarkable stuff tends to come, in my opinion, from the sound side of things. So that's really, really neat kind of connection that keeps coming back. So, kind of back on the hauntings side of things, I remember there were two other things. Well, there was something actually I wanted to mention too, because of that physical, that sensation and markings of a place, right? Now I went to Estonia with you when you first went out there, and I remember there was a park nearby the campus that we passed through, and I had a very dramatic sense of sorrow and foreboding when we entered that park. And I remember we talked about we were asking about whether or not did anything happen here, and we kind of questioned.
It's Estonia, yes.
Right, like. It's like, I don't think anything happened here, right? Like, this was all, I don't know, they were pretty quiet up here. And then later you found out some things about that, didn't you?
Well, Estonia has a very kind of a difficult history. As much as I love it, it's a wonderful place now, of course, but they had so many occupations throughout their history. The Germans, the Swedish, and the Soviet occupation was very hard on them. And Tartu was attacked many times, it, you know, bombed, and there were many fires. And I did hear that there were places where buildings were destroyed because of the war, and sometimes they were rebuilt, and sometimes they weren't. And these areas that kind of, it looks like a park, sometimes that's the case. It was just destroyed.
Just a leveled building.
In conflict. Yeah. Park.
Now, there was also what looked to me like a set of bunkers nearby that park. And I also remember you saying, telling a story about a tunnel.
A series of tunnels, yeah. This is also, I noticed them mostly on Tome Hill. There's these really interesting tunnel entrances. They're blocked off with wooden doors with a big, like, iron handle. It's, for someone like me, it's just inviting. I'm really curious. But I went on a haunted history tour in Tartu, and they told this story that these tunnels supposedly go very far. It's like a network, and they're supposed to go very deep and far throughout the city. And there was some story about children kept going down there, and they were told not to. And a group of kids went down there once, and they went so far down in there, and they whatever light they had with them went out, and they encountered something very terrifying. I don't know if there were sounds or if they were able to see anything, but they all ran as quickly as they could and came back out. And I think all of the three of them, and all of them had lost their sight for a number of days. I don't know if it ever came back. This is like, you know, an urban legend or something. I don't know if there's any truth to it, but yeah, it's kind of spooky. So I've never gone into these tunnels.
There's always, and it's interesting too, it's like you can always find a network of tunnels somewhere. Which is like another, like, I don't know, I've kind of noticed in terms of talking about these podcasts, it's like, how can we connect all these different things in like different parts of the world?
So tunnels.
You got like, literally. And I just kind of, I kind of find that funny, just kind of how tunnels and the underground becomes like another sort of myth making. And then also to just sort of the modern myth making that happens, or folklore that happens in terms of like World War II, a lot of wars that happened like the 60s and 70s and 80s in terms of occupations and whatnot. You know, it's very, very modern in many ways. It's like only the last like 100 years or so. And how sort of that landscape kind of creates myth and folklore, and then also two paranormal experiences that kind of go hand in hand. Or like urban legends is, it's kind of cool to kind of think about like urban legends in a way is another, is a modern day folklore in terms of like creating stories to either warn people or, you know, where's the truth in it, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So in Finland, they have a folk epic called the Kalevala. And Estonia has a very similar folk epic. It's called the Kalevala Poeg. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing these correctly, but I might have messed it up a little bit. But these are like the stories of the origins of the nation. And I visited Helsinki and I got to see the Kalevala. As performed as a ballet, because they were celebrating their centennial, like 100 years of independence. Yeah, both in Finland and Estonia. So this is my exposure to the story. And besides the origins they told of their civil war, because Finland had a civil war. They weren't occupied by the Soviets, but the Soviets and the Germans both really impacted the nation and kind of caused this civil war, and that was like part of that story. But there are also like these heroes, like the Kalevala is very much about this hero. And there was a similar story in Estonia about Suur Toll, which is literally is the giant hero. A friend of mine translated it for me, who gets like attacked by a devil and goes and tears it all apart. But these also get really tied up with a sense of nationalism. And coming from the United States, especially right now, I'm not too into nationalism. I have a lot of concerns about that kind of pride. And parts of Europe are concerned about it because it's led to war. Like Germany is very cautious about that. But for Finland and Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania, like they've gained their independence more recently.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like part of the way they're developing as a nation, like, or establishing
like a modern civ.
This sense of pride, you know. And in a way, I kind of appreciate it. It's a different perspective on nationalism and patriotism feels very different than when I witnessed that in the United States.
I know this is kind of not necessarily related to like paranormal and stuff, but it's kind of, I'm always fascinated about like the layers of time that happen as well. Or kind of like when you talk about like Afrofuturism or a different concept of dystopian futures and realities. Well, maybe it plays in, because sometimes I think it plays in terms of like United States and sort of our obsession with conspiracy theories and, you know, things happening or like changing, and how like the world is like a community or going through like these different layers of time in terms of like so like in one part of the world it's like a dystopian reality, and another person it's kind of like moving out of that and creating sort of like this new identity, and then other places in the world are, you know, maybe losing that identity or becoming really extreme and sort of things kind of unraveling and fraying. And so I don't know where I'm going with this. We could edit this out.
No, I think it's very relevant.
But though, I think it's really, and so kind of really, and I think in terms of like creating all of those like more like connections, I think the more you can kind of relate to something like outside of you, and it become less of this other or this like foreign or alien sort of concept. Because sometimes I think a lot of what a lot of paranormal sort of investigation does is it's really tied up with our psychology, kind of going back to that psychoreactive sort of phenomenon, and how it would be really interesting to see from like a psychoreactive phenomenon how different places around the world, kind of what those psychic phenomena are.
Oh yeah, that's a really awesome question, because I was like different cultural how different people respond to what we would call paranormal phenomenon, and what do you feel like the general attitude of Estonians are around it?
Well, it depends on the subject. One that I feel like I've heard a lot of people talk very openly about is werewolves. This is a big part of their...
like the best segue ever.
Well, and it's particularly interesting. So werewolves are a big part of the stories that they, the traditional stories that they have. And I was interested to hear that. Like, yeah, you know, a lot of cultures have beliefs about shapeshifters, and werewolves are in many different cultures. But specifically in Estonia, werewolves are talked about as typically being female. In fact, I think almost every single time I've heard any reference of it, and it's been female werewolves. And there's a lot of people doing research on those stories, those tales, and it was really interesting. It was like, you know, a woman would be like, oh, I'm going to go on a walk in the woods and collect some berries or some mushrooms.
Mushrooms.
Yeah. No. It's mushrooming is a very, not those kinds of mushrooms.
No, I know. I'm just being a butthead.
But, yeah, just going to go out into the woods and then come across like, oh, who's this old lady? Okay, I'll go with her. And then she gives me this magical skin that, oh, and we put this, I put the skin on and she puts one on too. And then we go off and go hunting together while they transformed into wolves. Yeah.
So it's like a sulky story, but like with like the skin, so putting on a skin, but it's like with a wolf.
Yes, yeah. And I've heard some kind of similar stories of shape changing. There's a lot of beliefs about shape changers in India, among some of the indigenous groups of India. Many of them are were tigers, and there's were snakes. And I've heard either they have a ritual in that.
The Naga.
Yeah, the Naga. Yes, I heard more about the were tigers. They had a ritual to become the were tiger. It's like you had to have certain items and do, you know, these specific things with these items, and then kind of meditate and get into a trance, and you would become the tiger. Or there might be this idea of having a skin that you put on and you become the creature.
Yeah. So this kind of this idea of a shapeshifter is actually very common throughout different cultures. In the idea, even the older traditions of werewolves talk about it's more of a sorcery. It's a type of sorcery. Hey, there's somebody less of a curse, actually, it's not like somebody's born into being a werewolf in these traditional stories. Go ahead.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I did look at one academic paper about the werewolves in Estonia. Most of this research is done in Estonian. There's not much of it in English, unfortunately, because it's so interesting. But they didn't have a negative view of werewolves, in my understanding, and this is particularly interesting. It came up in context of like witch hunts,
right,
and the trials that they were having. So, and during that time, I believe Estonia was occupied or being controlled by German barons and such. And so they would say, oh, do you know of any witches or anyone who's maybe like werewolves or something? And they would say, oh yeah, you know, I know of a werewolf. And but they wouldn't think it was a bad thing. And so I don't think anybody was like prosecuted for that, but they did have a concept of so there's magic, and that's not a bad thing. But there's good magic, and then there's bad magic, right?
Right, right. So good magic and bad magic, and yeah, it definitely doesn't feel like there's the same kind of negative connotation that particularly Europe and some Americans sort of have of that kind of creature. And what I think is fascinating, too, is, and I want to get your idea on it, do you feel like this is like a contemporary recognition? Like, do contemporary Estonians recognize this as just a real thing, or does it feel like more like just a legendary part of their culture?
I haven't gotten the sense necessarily that people believe this is a real thing now. I can't say for sure. I don't know. But as far as like people believing in some sort of mythological creature is real, I have heard of that in Bulgaria and Romania. There was one story from some people that I sing with that had been to Bulgaria, and they sang a song in English. They were asked to sing an English song. And so they sang Zombie Jamboree, which is a very cutesy and funny song about some zombies. And the people, they, you know, these were Bulgarian villagers. They didn't understand English, and they really enjoyed the music. And the song ended, and they asked someone, a translator, what was the song about? And the person who could translate couldn't think of the word for zombie in Bulgarian. So she said, oh, it's like about vampires. And they stopped laughing. They were like, that is not funny. You do not joke about that. You shouldn't have been, yeah, you shouldn't sing that song. So, yeah, I don't know, I like these kinds of places where it's still alive, but then I haven't had, like, a really scary experience where it's like, oh, it's not funny. I mean, I wonder why that person has that feeling.
Sorry, I was like, my mind went on, like, a tangent, and I was, like, trying to think of what it was that was in my brain, but kind of the idea of, sometimes like that those experiences are so private in some ways. Like it's really, I find that fascinating. Which is like maybe an important thing. You don't want necessarily like that exposure or that whatever, but if it's real, a lot of times it's very, never mind, I've lost my language.
But it feels more alive in some of these places. Like I spent a month in a very rural village in Romania, and it was so quiet at night, and we there weren't a whole lot of lights, and we were living in a very basic way, and I just remember this kind of stillness, and sometimes that was peaceful, but there were a couple nights where I was like, I don't know what's going on right now, but this village feels really freaky. And there was one time when in broad daylight, the middle of the day, I decided I was going to go on a walk outside of the village to the mountain, and I finally made it to the forest, and I was like, this is great. I love hiking. I go hiking in the mountains of Colorado all the time and get lost, you know, in some trees. So I started hiking into the forest, and it was like if you've seen this cartoon scene where someone comes to a path and suddenly there's like one direction they can go where it's all dark and it's all these thorny bushes and there's flashes of lightning. It felt like I found that place in real life, and I was walking in there, and it was like, even though it was broad daylight, the trees were so thick and the bushes were so thick that it was extremely dark, and I was like, I need to get out of here. There's bears and wolves, and I could die.
And who knows what else?
Right, exactly. It was Transylvania, after all.
Well, and it's interesting, too, like, this might be in something for another time or topic, but the idea of how environment or location or the space you're in interacts with those feelings and the psychic phenomenons and those tales. Because I think, for example, just kind of comparing, you know, Colorado, some of those woods have, like, a very different energy and feel to them than if you're, like, in Oregon, like in those woods. You know, you get the sense that there's something more, a little bit more life, something kind of like lurking around a corner. And it might be just because of like comfort and like experience in terms of growing up here, but I always thought that was really interesting. Like a forest has like a life force. And they have like an identity. And, you know, like when there's layers and layers and layers of history in terms of like, maybe phenomenon that gets imprinted on a place. That's just really interesting.
I definitely can speak to that or attest to that because I had never felt fear of the forest before all my whole life growing up in Colorado. I had a healthy respect, and there were definitely a number of times where I felt like maybe there was something there that maybe I don't need to be around. Right, and but when I went to Maryland, actually, that was the first time I ever felt like the darkness. Like there was a clear threshold in those woods, like straight up Blair Witch stuff, you know, for lack of any better way to describe it. And it felt like there was some anger. There was something not at peace in those woods, and that was the first time I ever experienced that. And also, I felt some magical, strangely magical things in Romania and Estonia, a lot of the places we've been to.
Yeah, I did. I am reminded that this is a little bit further back, but when we were in France, and I found an abandoned house or an abandoned building.
Like one does.
Yes. It was abandoned building. It was very...
No, like Savvy does.
Yeah. By the way, my nickname is Savvy. So, yes, it was like a 4 or 5 story building, and I was like, let's go check this out. And Jason was like, I don't know if that's safe. And I was like, cool, we're going. And
it was a monastery. It was an abandoned monastery.
We found out it seems like it was an abandoned monastery, and we went in there. The door was just open. I mean, it's like the beginning of a horror movie. Yeah, we went inside, it was empty. We went up
the vampires came out and ate you.
Well, no, we went up the stairs, and we reached maybe the second or third floor and noticed there was some fire damage. Mm-hmm. And that was when I was like, oh, this is like structurally not safe, so maybe we should consider going back down. But there was that number painted like 17 something, 1776. I don't know if that was a date. It was on the inside, like on the third floor. And just as we were like, oh, maybe we should go back down, we heard something.
1776.
Yeah.
Revolution.
We heard footsteps above us, like something, like there was a person on the floor above us, but there was like this fire damage, and there's no way anyone else would have been in there, so.
And this is a rickety, rickety spiral staircase with like kind of some kind of like adobe walls kind of thing, and wood, and things were falling out, and like I don't think anybody could actually, the floor would not hold the weight of a full-grown human being.
Yeah, but it sounded like someone was up there. And there was, like, a loud cannon sound that came from the outside at the same moment. So we just, like, got out of there as quickly as we could. And,
unlike most horror films.
Yeah, and we got out alive, and I had bad feelings about it. And then I didn't think much about it, and... It's like a month or so later, and I had already returned back to the United States, and I had nightmares about this place and like visions of like a shadowy figure there. So it almost felt like, in a way, I had brought something back. Yeah.
Which is a one of the fundamental lessons of a paranormal investigator. Whenever going into a haunted place, we take precautions to prevent things from coming back with us. But in this case, we were on vacation.
Right. But actually, the fact that I had this dream about a shadowy figure, it always reminded me of something I learned about later, which is in Judaism, there's a story of these creatures called Shedim. And the Shedim are in between creatures. Like, they're not quite a part of this realm, and they're not quite a part of whatever other realm, like hell or heaven or whatever, I don't know, other places. They're just in between everything. And they're supposed to be kind of shadowy and live in these abandoned buildings. And I learned about that concept later, and they're really supposed to be dangerous, like stay away from the Shedim. The origin story is like God was creating everything, the Jewish origin story, and on the seventh day, then God rested, right? This is the big thing. And I guess when that happened, when the seventh day came, God was in the middle of making Shedim. And he was like, oh, well, or he or she or they was like, I need to rest now. And the Shedim was like not finished. So that's why the Shedim is like this in-between
kind of
spooky trickster spirit. Yeah. Almost like a fairy, trickster fairy. But yeah, I was like,
Or the djinn.
Yeah.
And actually in our research, we did kind of connect the Shedim with djinn and fae kind of beings in that element. But yeah, that was a pretty interesting kind of experience too. The idea of certain energies and certain beings existing in different areas, actually, coming back to Estonia now, goes right to the onto the website. And
Visit Estonia.
Yeah.
That'd be a great place to kind of end, too, in terms of talking about just using that as like a tourist thing. Because we all did like... South Anna showed us this thing in terms of you can go on to Visit Estonia and find out what kind of mythical creature you are just by picking on some pictures. And then from that, like, what's your character, basically, and then where you should go visit.
Yeah, it's really cool. And they have so many mythological beings, mythological creatures in Estonia that I still don't know all of them. But again, also, you can watch the Curly music video. Feral Hearts, and you'll see many of them. She becomes many of them in that music video, which is in English, even though she's Estonian and it is about Estonia. But yeah, it's a really fun little quiz.
So which one were you?
I was Kivialune. So this is, it's kind of like a rock or earth spirit. It says, you are a tough and independent spirit, loving solitude, peace, and quiet. So yeah. I guess it was just like, you're the introvert. Go hide in a cave. It's pretty accurate.
But it also actually kind of speaks to, and they do a great job of it on the website, where it speaks to what sort of places these beings are said to inhabit and what the relationship to the people is with that place, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I also am kind of tickled to acknowledge that how accurately, I'd say, they tend to be lining up with our personalities. Did you get, Janine?
I got the, I think it's N-A-K-K, so Nock.
N-A-K-K,
yeah. Nock, so it was like a river and lake being, which I thought was kind of funny. So it was like a mysterious but volatile creature. And it kind of mimics the La Llorona myth of the idea of like dragging young children into the depths of the river and the lake. So I guess I'm just a vicious bitch. I don't know. but at the same time, but you know, it's more than that, which I thought was interesting because the first time I took it, I was like an island creature.
Which is still kind of watery.
Which is still, like, I think it's interesting both of them are water, considering I...
There's so much water in Estonia.
Yeah. Because it was like an... but I took the second one, thinking I'd get that same one again. And then I decided to take it several times. And I got it. I got the knock all three times.
Oh, okay.
So I was like, I thought it was really fascinating. But then what was really intriguing in terms of, like, the places you should go, and, like, now I really want to, like, research them. Because, one, I'm really fascinated by bogs. Just from, like, an anthropological perspective of, like, how much shit's in there that you could study.
That's true.
In the waste, you know, because we learn a lot from the poop, the vomit that comes out of us, and that's preserved.
This is insane.
And then also, like, witch wells. And so I'm really intrigued to kind of look that up. But I just thought that was a really cool mechanism in terms of, like, intriguing a person in terms of, like, studying a place. Getting to know it, and I thought that was really interesting. Because now I'm, like, really curious, like, what sort of places are in Estonia that I would be interested in traveling to.
Yeah. On that note, there's a crater. There's a crazy crater.
I've never visited it, but, yeah, I've heard about it.
Kind of like Crater Lake in Oregon, because that's got some weird stuff.
This one's much smaller than Crater Lake, but I believe it was formed by a meteor. And it's, you know, it's just a really interesting place. I don't know if anything spooky happens there.
From what I recall, it was, it's noted as like a witch well, right? Ah. It was kind of a, it's like this just beautifully pristine freshwater lake in the middle of the forest. And it's deep and, deep and clear. And folks recognize it as a kind of a powerful place in the older tradition, too. But I don't know too much about it. Came up on my Atlas Obscura when I was looking at places to visit when we went to Estonia. But I guess I should check out some of the forests, because I am a Hid.
You're Hid.
I'm a Hid. I am the hero of the holy forests, a powerful and mighty spirit, a natural communicator, always seeking someone to talk to. I am truly happiest being the center of attention.
I can see that.
No, give me the microphone. Just like a Hid, a giant standing tall in the midst of it all, for you, it is usually all about impressing others and being admired, which is why being a bit of a show-off who loves challenges and demonstrations of personal strength is not at all strange to you. Fun to be around, you are also rather easy to anger as well. Therefore, it is important to cool down after throwing trees and stones around.
It sounds a lot like Suurtool, the giant hero of Estonia myth.
Yes, Suurtool, which in Estonian legend there's a number of other giants, right? Estonian legends tell about giants.
Yeah, this goes back to the Kalevi Poeg. And Suurtool, just a note for anybody who's interested, there's some really interesting and beautiful illustrations that were done to tell this story. It was there was a book that was created. There's also a cartoon that was made about Suurtool that can be found on YouTube. And I've talked to, you know, people in Estonia who grew up seeing that as a small child, and it terrified them. So, you know, as an adult, you might enjoy it. And folks might find it interesting, but don't show it to any little kids.
Although horror as children's stories, there is a lot of cross-cultural traditions.
Yeah.
As you know, they're teaching opportunities.
Maybe there is some story of war. You know, the giant has to come rescue the people and defend from war, so people die in this tale.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess, like, it's kind of interesting. I guess I'm not as... There's, like, the... Oh, I'm sorry, I'm just rereading my thing. Huh, interesting.
Yes, very interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I'd say, is there any... Did we miss anything? Was there anything else that we needed to cover?
Oh my gosh, there's so much. I mean... There's so much to talk about. The one thing we didn't get to talk about, which maybe I could talk about briefly, was the esoteric sex presentation that I...
You can't forget the esoteric sex.
No, my God, who could forget that?
Ritual blood, sex magic.
Yeah, it was really interesting. So just before I left Tartu, there was a presentation by this person who's been doing academic research on Aleister Crowley. He's written a book about Aleister Crowley that looks very interesting.
Heck. not the author, but Crowley.
Crowley. So this is the person who did this all this research is Marco Passi, and he's a professor in the history of Hermetic philosophy at the University of Amsterdam. And this presentation was just so interesting because
it's just something you can study.
That's something, yeah, you can study, by the way, in folklore. It's great. But one thing that I thought was interesting about this is he said, based on his research, the roots of sexual magic were actually primarily in the United States. Many people think that it was in Europe. And another big takeaway, that it was developed in Christian terms rather than pagan. Because nowadays, you know, there's this resurgence of sex magic, and a lot of it is like some kind of pagan concept. So to think that it came out of Christian ideology or practices.
That's actually, sorry to interrupt, but that's actually kind of prevalent if you read like Edward Waite's writings about the tarot and stuff. There's a lot more Christian theology built in, like from the Rosicrucian and all that stuff. So yeah, it's a lot more Gnostic Christianity, all that.
Or just kind of like how the United States really, especially like if you think about the burndown district and then the 1800s and that resurgence of like esoteric knowledge, a lot of it was incubated in the United States and then was brought back over to Europe.
Yes, exactly. And what he said about this, the reason this happened is the United States was like a place of experimentation, exploration. There was a little bit more freedom of expression in a certain way that people could really explore these things. So there was like these, it was a bit more radical, and he even connected it to like feminist explorations. And he said that this was in some of these publications from this esoteric sex and ritual sex magic. This was some of the first places that people were talking about the female orgasm. And a lot of the people doing this work, this sex magic work, you always hear about Aleister Crowley and some of the other big names, which I can't remember, but it's often men that you hear about. But he said that there were a whole bunch of women who were very active in this. And he named Katniss or something was one of them. And there's a couple of others who like wrote prolifically on these topics, and I found that to be very interesting. I just wanted to make sure that we got touched on that.
No, that's really cool, and that's because like one of the things that would be a cool thing to just talk about in general is just
a whole
sort of
episode about it.
Well, just like the burndown district in general, you know, like you know, Mormonism really took hold there. You know, a lot of different sects of Christianity, a lot of it was ripe for a lot of like occult sort of things. It's really fascinating, or like even talking about like a lot of traditions that are a lot like from India and things like that. A lot of things, like when they were being occupied, a lot of things got like taken away and lost, and then a lot of people who are like here kind of brought it back over. And so it's kind of interesting that cultural exchange of like magic,
kind of like blues and gospel and bluegrass turned into rock and roll, and then the Europeans got a hold of it and then made it popular. It's like four British dudes.
Yeah.
Got a hold of it, made it popular, and now everybody talks about them. Like.
Yeah. It's kind of, but it's really interesting. It's really true, though. It's kind of like, I think it would just be really fascinating. Kind of like language groups, right? Like linguistic groups. Like looking at like magical groups and kind of how they travel. Anyway, I'm done.
Yeah. Well, it's been fun. I'm glad to talk about Estonia because it's such a, you know, it's a small country and underappreciated, I think, sometimes. It's 6 times smaller than the state of Colorado. That's my reference as a Coloradan.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it's really small. But it's gorgeous. I mean, I still haven't seen all of it, and it has a lot to offer. The culture has a lot to offer, and there's even more things I didn't even get to talk about, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's
podcast number two.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll have to have you back, won't we? And if anybody is interested in following the Crypto Science Society, you can find us at our website, cryptosciencesociety.com, or also on Facebook and Instagram and YouTube.
We're on all of it.
All of it. Except Twitter. No Twitter.
Ugh.
No Twitter. Should we Twitter?
No.
No, no Twitter.
We're not tweeting.
No.
tweeting twats. No, I don't know. I hate Twitter.
Well, there you have it, folks. Official stance of the Crypto Science Society is anti-Twitter. You can share that. But that's all for today. Join us next time when we will talk about something
else.
They're equally mysterious and entertaining.
We should do aliens next.
We did aliens.
I can't remember what we did. We've done Bigfoot, aliens, psychoreactive phenomena. We should do Mothman next.
All right.
Okay, we're going to do the Mothman next.
Cool. As they say in Estonia, Suur aitäh.
Suur aitäh.
Yes, big thank you.
Big thank you.
Big thank you. Cool.
All right.